very meaningfully in chapel this morning. We have crossed a line today. We are now in Lent, and many of you bearing the ashes on your forehead, a symbol of what we bear indeed in our heart. The texts for today's lectionary at lunch are the texts of Lent 2. The Old Testament lesson is Genesis 28, 10 to 17. New Testament is Mark, and someone, I hope not me, will be here to deal with the New Testament part of it. We want to work with the Old Testament. This is one of those Sundays where, no matter how much I work on it, it's not obvious to me why these two texts were put together. I don't see any linguistic or any thematic overlap here, which is as obvious as sometimes it is on occasions. There are a few things, though, that did occur to me, and when we get to the end of that, I'll mention a few of those. Let's look at the text. Happily, it is very straightforward. Most of the vocabulary, in fact, should be familiar to folks who have mastered whatever numbers are assigned to that course in biblical readings. You look down at the apparatus and you see there is only one note there. There are, in other words, absolutely no textual problems at all. So that part is a delight. Let's work our way through it. And Jacob went from Beersheba, and he journeyed. Different translations, the older translations say to Haran, more recent translations say toward Haran, and I think that's probably the more proper sense here, because you look at the context below our pericope here and you find out he's only at Bethel. He's only started. He's only begun to move out. Distance we're talking about here is a distance in miles of about 60, 65 miles or so from Beersheba to Bethel. If you're on foot, however, it's probably more than a day's hike. All right, so he's on his way. He's on his way, in fact, in part as a result of the trick that he played on his older brother Esau. And he's there on his way to get a wife, indeed, but there's a mixture of things involved in this trip, in any case. And he came in or to the place, an unspecified the place. We're going to see that the place, however, at several points in this pericope, and likely is defined by what we have down below, Bethel. From the point of view of the narrator, the place is identified. From the point of view of the flow of the text here, it's still a little bit unspecified, even though the direct object is there. He approached, came to the place, and he spent the night there. Motel 6, what do you figure? Holiday Inn? You wonder where people of this time spent the night. It's not like, in other words, you just check in somewhere. There's a little bit of significance to this, however, that I think we pick up only down below. He came to the place, he spent the night there because the sun went down. Darn. The sun just all of a sudden went down. Couldn't see where he was going anymore. And so he took from the stones of that place, and he set, you have to imply the word it, and the next word there, mara'ashothau. You can see the root is rosh, right, head. You see a pronominal suffix, his something of the head, or for the head, a place for the head. In the old translation, this was translated pillow, something to put his head on. Newer translations don't even, the NIV or NRSV, neither one, use that. I wouldn't be totally out of place. In China, a context that I spent some years in ministry, pillows were made of porcelain or other just unforgiving, unbending things, you know. So it would not be totally, you know, out of place to use the word pillow here. In any case, he took one of the stones, and that was what he used as what he put his head on when, as the next part says, he lay down or he went to sleep in that in this place. And he dreamed, and behold, a sulam, mutzav. Mutzav is from the root natzav, which is really to stand, or mutzav is a hofal participle, something that has been made to stand up, or something that had been set up there, standing there. A sulam. Only time in Scripture it's used. It refers older translation, and what we're more familiar with would say ladder. We're cautioned, however, as we read the commentators, not to think in terms of the ladder that you use when you paint the side of the house, kind of a ladder. The word itself, the root of the word salal, has the connotation of heaping up, a heap, a mound, a pile of some kind. And so an alternate translation would say a ramp or a stairway like that that goes up the side of a hill. Or if you look at the notes of the Concordia Self-Study Bible, it says, picture in your mind the ziggurat, that kind of a temple sort of a thing that was built in the Babylonian, the Mesopotamian area, which was kind of meant to be an ascent to heaven. The God lived up on the top there. That kind of a ladder is what we're talking about, not the hook and ladder kind of a ladder. All right, he dreamed, and behold, there was this ladder standing on the ground, or the earth, either one, and its head was reaching. There's another another participle there, hifil participle, naga, to extend to touch, to reach. And its head was touching to the heavens. You've got a hey on both ends of that word. The definite article as well as the directional word. And behold, angels of God were going up and coming down, both participles on it. Continual process, in other words. And behold, Yahweh stood. That's the same word as we had two lines above at the end, that hofal participle, same root. There it was, the hofal, that which was set up, and here it's to stand, was standing. And you look at different translations and you have different readings. The NIV says, and Yahweh was standing on it. That is to say, on the ladder, on the top of that ramp up there. And indeed, the ziggurat, that kind of an image, was built in order to make your way up to the top, and up at the top was the shrine where the God was. So we're using that kind of a picture here. Yahweh was at the end of this ladder here. The other translation, and the NRSV follows the other translation, says Yahweh was standing by him. And the alau then refers to a person and not to a place. And there's nothing in the words to choose one over the other. My personal preference is to think probably on it. Given the context here, probably makes more sense, particularly if we use that image of the ramp up to heaven. And he said, I am Yahweh, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac, comma. Okay, there's the Athnach there, so you stop there. The land which you are sleeping on it, land on which you are sleeping, to you I will give it and to your seed. Okay, the I will give it looks, that's a lot of dogishes and a lot of other dots there. Nathan, Kal, with a feminine suffix. I am giving it, that is the land. And it will be, that is, your seed. Just pull down your seed from the end of verse 13. We're beginning verse 14 with that. Your seed as the dust of the earth. Two images given in the promise to the patriarchs. One is the dust of the earth, and that follows through on the image that you have in chapter 13, verse 16. In the covenant pericope from chapter 15, it's the stars of the heaven. Depends on whether you're looking up or looking down. Meaning is the same. As much dust as there is out there in the dirt, on the earth, that's how many your seed will be. And in fact, it will, you will expand, explode, spread, stretch. And there are four directional words put together here. To the sea, that is to say to the west, all right? The Mediterranean is to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the Negev, which is to the south. So you've got the four compass points all registered here. Your seed will spread that far. And they will be blessed in you. That is, all the families of the ground. In you and in your seed. Okay? What we have here, in other words, is an extension of Genesis 12, that initial call and that promise to Abraham. This last part is situated here as it is in that call to Abraham. It follows anything else that's up there. And in this case, we've got land, we've got progeny, and then all the nations of the earth will be, all the families of the earth will be blessed through you. The other blessings, the land, the progeny, exist for the sake of all the nations being blessed. Okay? The mission outreach, the mission dimension of what's going on is built into, and in fact is the climax of, the other blessings that are given to the patriarchs. Another way to say it, the life of Jacob is, the nations have a stake in the life of Jacob, all right? Life of Jacob is of interest not just to Jacob or to his children or to his ancestors. The life of Jacob exists for the sake of all the families of the earth, just as it was true for his father, his grandfather, Abram. Behold, Anoki Imak, lovely, I am with you. Immanuel, registered right there at the beginning. I am with you. And not only that, U Shamartika, I will care for you, I will guard you, I will keep you, I will preserve you. Bakol Esher Telek, in everywhere you go. Isn't that marvelous? It's almost kind of like Matthew 28, right? Go, I'll be with you to the end of the age. And here it's not the end of the age, it's the end of the earth. Wherever you go. Clearly, Jacob is leaving the promised land. And I think that's part of what's at stake here. He's leaving the promised land. And yet, that is not a hindrance to Yahweh. Yahweh is not just a tribal deity. He's not just a clan god. He is not tied to the geography of any given land. Wherever you go, the promise is, I will be with you. Yahweh has a claim on all people and on all places. And I will bring you back. The root is shuv. We've got a hifil here with a wow consecutive. The perfect carries an imperfect sense. I will cause you to return. I will bring you back. We've got the pronominal suffix there. To the land, this land, 4. I will not azav you. I will not forsake you. I won't let you dangle out there. I won't leave you stuck out there. Until I do, asithi, asa, to do, to accomplish, eth asher debarti lak, that which I have spoken to you. The promise continues, it lingers. All right. And Jacob, Vayikatz, to Yakatz, to awake. And he awoke from his sleep, and he said, Akin, from the word kun, which is the word to establish. It's almost like the word amen here. Surely, certainly, it is, you know, it is a fact. It is for sure that. Akin. Yesh Adonai b'makom hazeh. There is Yahweh in this place. Yahweh is indeed in this place, and that yesh is a strong word here. It's a claim of a presence. Wanoki lo yadati, and I didn't know it. His image of God was smaller than the God who revealed himself to Jacob. And he feared, or that's the way most translations translate it. Yare, however, is used equally for worship. And in fact, the two really need to blend into each other, because there is an element of the fear in the worship, and often that worship, the fear can carry a sense of reverence or a sense of worship with it. And he feared. He worshipped, and he said, how nora, participle from yare, to fear, how fearful, how to be feared, okay? How marvelous, how fearful, how awesome, hamakom hazeh, this place. Ein ze ki imbeth Elohim. The ein ze ki im is a strong way of saying there ain't no way it's not going to be, or it ain't no way it isn't. Okay? Ain't no way it isn't. Beth Elohim, the house of God. This is, in other words, this is clearly, this is obviously, it's certainly the house of God. And indeed, this is the Sha'ar HaShamayim, the gate to heaven itself. All right, marvelous stuff, just really marvelous stuff. Connectors between this and the gospel, which is the gospel of person can't, by doing anything for himself, purchase his own soul, let him deny himself, take up his cross, follow me, that claim of discipleship. One thought comes to mind. God is in this place, a claim that Jacob was not aware of before he got there, before Yahweh came to this place and revealed himself to Yahweh, to Jacob. The cross of Christ, God is in this place, a claim that is foolishness, right? To both Greek and Jew, and yet God is in this place. And I think that makes for a marvelous bridge between those two. It takes the revelation of God to know that. No one else would guess that. It can only be that by the design of God that it can be that, and yet it is that. God is in this place, and I didn't even know it. I would not have guessed it. One. Another one. Jacob. We tend sometimes to idolize the heroes of the Old Testament. Jacob, however, when you read his story, when you try to read it, you know, without all the Sunday school stories that we bring with us, one of the characterizations of Jacob is that he's the cheat. He was cheating when he came out of the womb, right? He cheated his brother. He laughed at his name. That's Isaac. He was a cheat from the word go, a usurper. He is somehow in the kingdom. God can bless and God can sanctify and God can use the most unlikely of people, the most unlikely of tools. So the cross. Who would have guessed? And yet God can come into this and use this, and as Dr. Johnson mentioned in the sermon this morning, carries over into this pericope, the Mark pericope we're talking about. The sufferings that we go through are sanctified and dignified, and they do not represent separation from God. That's where we get close to God. Okay, I think that's all I'm going to do. Jim, you didn't even get a chance to get your teeth dirty. Okay, yes, please. Right. Whether it's a typological connection or whether you say, yeah, what was happening, what John is talking about is the fulfillment, you know, just the expanding and exploding of what was going on in Jacob's case. That being the case, Jacob recognized this place where the ramp was, and he called it Bethel. It used to be called Almond Tree, Luz. Gave it a new name because it had a new identity, thank you. And so Jesus Christ was that place where God's presence is here among us. Yeah.